Now on News Talk, as part of our winter season of documentary on News Talk, producer Anthony McFeely examines the changing discourse around Ireland's drug problem and speaks to those most closely affected by drugs and addiction. In Decriminalising Addiction, Changing Ireland's Approach to Drug Policy.
I can remember starting to take them, you know, and forgetting about it. I forgot about it. I didn't forget about it all the time either, you know. It'd be nights when I was lying down in bed, like, you know what I mean, in a ball of pain, like, you know, and that's when I'd run to escape again. I suppose I was on a suicide mission, you know.
I found myself really emotionally raw. You cry. It's not so much flashback as more think back, feel back.
Didn't want to be me, never wanted to be me, and I think part of me over the years hate myself. It was terrifying then. I wasn't sleeping and you're bleeding. I was in bits in there.
It was horrendous, it really was. The mental symptoms that appear, you know, the aches and pains, the chills, the shivers, the sneezing fits. In tandem with that, there's what's going on psychologically.
I arrested a young man, a very, very skinny young lad. I arrested him in a plaster mouldings factory up in Dolphin's Barn. I charged him with burglary, I released him. He didn't appear in court. About 3 weeks later, I was called to a flat in Dolphin House and I saw this individual lying dead on a couch, ballooned up. He was dead for several days and the heat was on or whatever, with a needle stuck in his arm. It is a vile addiction.
Ireland's prison population has increased from 600 in 1960 to almost 3,800 today. This increase has coincided with the strengthening of laws surrounding drug control, including the introduction of mandatory minimum sentencing for drug offences in 1999. A report released by the Drugs Misuse Division of the Health Research Board in 2014 showed that in spite of the efforts of lawmakers and Gardaí, Ireland's drug problem is more entrenched than ever, with increased usage, more violence within communities, and a lower age profile of those involved. Is it fair then to suggest that Ireland's policy is failing when it comes to drugs? Should a greater effort be made to understand and treat the causes of drug addiction? Should Ireland decriminalise drugs? Kevin is 47 and from Kerry. He's also a recovering drug addict.
I was raised by my grandmother and my uncle, and my grandmother would have passed away when I was about 11 and a half, 12. I never had a real connection with my parents, my mother and father. But my nan passed away anyway, I had to move back to the family home, which didn't work out. So I moved to a different area anyway, so there was different people around there, and a lot of them would have been into messing, you know, kids stuff, you know. But then we started to drink. There was more arguments than at home, you know, so I just started to get into more trouble as the months went by, never mind the years, the months, like, you know. And then I just started to smoke cannabis, like. Cannabis would have been maybe for a year or two then, you know, when the drinking started, the gambling even started, you know, when I was 13 or 14, you know. I remember going to the Greyhound racing and all of that, like, so to fund my gambling and my drinking and my cannabis smoking, you know, I started to do burglaries, rob cars and all of that kind of crime, you know. So I would have started to get into trouble at a very young age. That kept going until I was 15. In the E scene came in. I suppose I was taking ease and speed for 4 to 5, 6 years, and then cocaine came in, you know, which really manifested in my life, like, you know, with the price of it and everything, you know. So I started to get into a lot more trouble, started to deal drugs, do a lot more robberies. I got caught a couple of times, I was sent to prison.
Following his short sentence, Kevin travelled to England to forge a new life for himself. But it was while he was over there that he was introduced to crack cocaine and heroin, two substances which would plunge him into a year of reclusive addiction.
One of my friends came over then, you know, and he seen the state that I was in. You know, I remember him taking me to the ferry, like, and getting me on the ferry, you know, and I remember getting picked up off the ferry then. I remember getting brought home then, you know, and just spending a few weeks in home again, you know, just going through withdrawals. And but I got out of it, you know, I got out of it that time. I got into a relationship with a girl that was going all right for a few years. I was dabbling all right, you know what I mean? I was slowly but surely getting back into it again, you know, but thinking I could control it. But I couldn't. The heroin then was starting really to come around. I was getting sick of the high buzz all the time anyway, you know, because, like, I have childhood issues as well, you know. I suppose I can say it here, look, I was abused as a child and I never dealt with that at all. I never spoke to anyone about it, and I just carried it my whole life. That continued into my relationship. I felt bad in myself. I felt dirty sometimes. Do you know, I really did, like. So, do you know, I stayed in that relationship for 6 years. I really don't know how it lasted that long.
Trauma is a almost constant feature in the background of people in addiction. Trauma can be kind of big T trauma stuff or little T trauma, often with fairly early onset in early childhood, not necessarily. We'd kind of see addiction as, in some ways, representing a maladaptive coping strategy where people try to manage and modulate very difficult emotions through using what initially are effective kind of mood-altering substances, but then become a problem in their own right.
Dr. Erica Ruarock, their clinical and counselling psychologist and clinical services coordinator of the Rutland Centre in Templeogue in Dublin, explaining the relationship between trauma and addiction. It perhaps shed some light on why Kevin found himself locked in a decades-long battle with substance abuse.
I always, even at a young age, didn't you know, I got abused, like, you know, and I had older cousins as well, you know, and which would be 10 years older than me. Like, I would have been probably 13 then when I started to look up to them. They would have been 20, 21, 22. Do you know, even to start looking up to them and saying, look, nobody will ever again hurt me, like. But they were the ones with the drugs then, do you know. Do you know, and I can remember starting to take them, do you know, and forgetting about. I forgot about it. I didn't forget about it all the time either, do you know. There'd be nights when I was lying down in bed, like, do you know what I mean, in a ball of pain, like, do you know, and that's when I'd run to escape again.
Tony is 45 and from Ballymun. Like Kevin, he experienced difficulties in his early life and began drinking, smoking cannabis and gambling from a young age. He also served a number of short prison sentences for burglary and petty crime in his late teens and early 20s. He describes the prison experience.
Well, I always remember my first prison sentence, going into Patrick's. I'll always remember that, going in, and I was alone, I usually, so I kind of didn't be around people. And I remember going in there and being in that cell, and afraid, was a fear in me, don't ask. I couldn't ask for drugs, I was terrified, and then I wasn't sleeping and me bleeding. I was in bits in there, you know, I was terrified, and I thought I'd be never back here, nope, I'm never back here. It was a small, it was only a month sentence then I got. And I remember I was in for a week, and I thought when I got out there, I'm not about using drugs again. That bleeding terrified me in there. I'd always had a fear about prison earlier. And then I kind of, when I got the first sentence, I thought it wasn't that bad, but it didn't stop me, obviously, because I ended up back there, I think 6 months later, doing a 3 month sentence. And thinking I was the business this time going in, you know what I mean? I'm about to be in here, I know what the gig is, you know what I mean? It's not nice when you're bleeding, slopping out, pissing in the pot, in the cell, and then actually, you know, in the cell, and you're around people, so you're always kind of going around putting the front on. For me, I went around and there putting the front on there. Yeah, I'm all right, this boy was being full of fear back then, afraid, you know what I mean? I always said to myself, I never would do a big sentence. I think when I got big charges after I'd done me some, them little sentences, I probably would have took my life rather than going and doing a big sentence.
Tony also travelled to England following his jail term, where he would develop an addiction to heroin and later to methadone.
The longest I've had clean was when I went to England, and I call it clean, I would have been drinking and smoking hash, but to me that was clean back then. But I think I got a year and a half clean, and then I ended up going on to using heroin over there, going out dancing, rave scenes, and literally that just kept going. You know, my addiction was from a young age, and lived over there for 12 years thinking, yeah, And I thought, I'll move back to Ireland, get away from there, from the drugs. But I was bringing the same head with me, you know, it's the head that's on my shoulders. Came back here in 2001. I remember going back, selling everything I had, selling every bit of phones. I had a flat in Ballymun at the time, and selling everything and being left sleeping on the balcony that night. You know, addiction, and over the years, it's left me in the same places every time. I used to think I was doing all right. I got up, but I have a 22-year-old son now who we don't speak at the moment, haven't spoken for a couple of years. I used to think I was there for him and my wife and the family. I was there, but I was there in body, but not in any other way. And I mean, it was always where I wanted I was there, you know. And it's only, as I say, the carnage. I'm looking back now and seeing the damage I've done to everyone around me, I suppose, you know, to myself.
For both Tony and Kevin, we can see that criminal sanction did little to dissuade them from using drugs. In fact, in both cases, heroin dependency issues only arose after their release from prison. Both men committed crimes, including theft and burglary, however, and in the minds of most people, they would deserve punishment. Dr. Johnny Connolly is a criminologist with the Irish Health Research Board. He says the relationship between crime and drug use isn't that clear-cut.
In most cases, the vast majority of people who use drugs don't commit any offence except the offence of possession, of simple possession, because by virtue of the fact that a lot of substances are illegal, they are committing a crime through their possession. But we wouldn't refer to them as problematic drug users. So the sort of the connection between illicit drug use and offending behaviour is generally illustrated in a number of different models. Firstly, you have what's called the psychopharmacological connection. And this is where there's an association between the substance itself and the offending behaviour, usually violent behaviour. So, for example, we know from research that there's a clear link between the consumption of alcohol and violent offending, particularly, for example, public order offences in Ireland. There is some connections between, for example, perhaps crack cocaine and certain offences, but this would generally be seen as the social context in which illicit drugs are used rather than the actual property of the substance itself. And many drugs, for example, heroin, would have probably a reverse effect on people, an ameliorating effect. The second connection would be seen as, it would be what's referred to as economic or economic compulsive or acquisitive. And this is where people commit crimes to feed their habit, essentially. So robbery, theft, etc. And they're dependent users, and they're feeding their habit, basically, a drug habit. The third connection would be what's referred to as the systemic connection. And this is where, because of the virtue of the fact that drugs are illegal, and because there is still a consistent demand for drugs, well, then that creates an illegal market. And one of the consequences of that illegal market, of course, is that there can be, because of the amount of money that's there to be made, there can be conflict over territorial control. And then the final sort of causative connection is called the common cause model. And this says that illicit drugs doesn't cause crime, but both the consumption of illicit drugs and offending behaviour are both common. They're common factors, but there might be other causes. For example, poverty, you know, early school leaving, social factors. So what they would say is that drugs does not cause crime, but both are the consequences of other factors.
You should be addressing the causes of criminality, whether they be linked to addiction, whether it be linked to poverty, whether it be linked to social exclusion, lack of education, lack of employment. Addressing those issues really effectively, devoting sufficient resources, both human and financial, to looking at those causes in order to reach a solution, rather than simply resorting to lengthy terms of imprisonment, which have, you know, a significant economic cost. So we're talking about €65,000 a year. That money could be put to really much better effect if it was invested in, for example, you know, effective drug treatment centres, effective prevention and early intervention when it comes to younger people in particular.
That was Deirdre Malone, Executive Director of the IPRT, Irish Penal Reform Trust, outlining the financial cost of applying a custodial sentence and how the money might be better spent when it comes to dealing with people with addiction problems.
It's where I first encountered it in terms of seeing it being sold. So it was sold around me all the time, but I had absolutely no interest in it whatsoever. By that stage, I was like, I was getting jobs. I was working. If I went out at that time, it would probably be a couple of drinks.
Niall O'Connell is from Crumlin in Dublin. He works as an advocate on behalf of SERF, the Service Users Representative Forum. He's also a recovering heroin addict. When he was 14 years old, he and his mother moved out of the family home due to domestic violence.
My mother was offered some housing, and the housing she was offered was the public housing flats. Initially, it was Fatima Mansions, which when we went in, and like this was in the 80s, so we went in, we looked, and we said, Jesus, no way, you know. It was a flat complex, which was just across the road from Fatima Mansions, called Dolphin Hills, and that's where I moved into. In 1990, when the kind of the rave scene came to Dublin, I began to mix in a different circle. Now the circle wasn't people in my immediate environment in Dolphin Hills. It was a different set of people. My first use of heroin was with when I was with those people. These were people who would have been from what would be termed middle class or upper middle class backgrounds.
Niall's story differs slightly to that of Kevin and Tony. His heroin use wasn't habitual at first, but after experiencing work-related stress, as well as other personal events in his life, a chance encounter with an acquaintance who offered him heroin would lead him down the path of addiction.
I was back in their place, and the file came out, and do you want to do a few lines? I said yes, because I felt like doing a few lines, and that led to more. I was coming back for more and more for a number of reasons. I know everyone experiences stress, and you know, it can be argued why not just, you know, deal with it the way any other person would deal with it. But it's all completely individual. The experience is completely individual. It depends on the environment you're in, the people you're with, and because it was available and because I was working and I had cash, I used it habitually. I used to have a mantra years ago, like when I was quite young, quite naive, that I would never become a heroin addict. And I ingrained that in my consciousness, and yet it happened. Like even other people have said that they considered me as the last person that they could envisage becoming addicted to heroin, and I myself was the last person that I could envisage myself becoming addicted to heroin. But it happened, and it was just like a grand conjunction of events, and that. You know, I was feeling pretty raw for quite a long period of time, and with depression as well. I just found that I found like the sedative qualities of heroin were completely seductive.
Although he was never given a custodial sentence, Niall's drug use did land him in trouble with the law.
I was quite lucky. I was brought up. Up before a court, I had scored one bag of heroin, and I was caught with that by the drugs unit at one of the stations near to where I was living at the time. They said, "Have you any drugs on you?" And I just said, "Yeah, I have got drugs on me." You know, they were gonna find them anyway, so it wasn't, you know. So I said, "I've a 20 euro bag of heroin in my pocket," and so they asked me to take it out. I took it out, I gave it to them, and then they cuffed me, put me into the car, brought me down to the station, booked me in, brought me into a cell with two other detectives, and then they proceeded to interrogate me as to who I bought the heroin off. When they knew I wasn't going to be forthcoming with any information, they said they wanted to do a strip search. So they done a strip search, and during the strip search, they were continuing to press me for information. I just continued with the initial story that I had told them about where I had acquired my £20 bag of heroin at the time. They weren't buying it, but they weren't getting any information.
Niall found himself before the district court, although he managed to avoid getting a criminal record.
I asked my solicitor at the time, could they do everything they could to try and ensure that a conviction isn't recorded, if they can. And I added all, you know, information that may help mitigate. Because I knew it would be at the judge's discretion. The detectives basically presented what they had, and I had said that I had scored at €20, so I wasn't contesting any of their evidence. So he applied the Probation Act.
You're listening to Decriminalising Addiction, Changing Ireland's Approach to Drug Policy on News Talk 106 to 108.
I was in Kilmainham between 1987 and 1997, and at that time, and I believe it may still be the case, we had the highest number of people convicted of criminal offences in all of Europe. The A District encapsulated Kilmainham and Kevin Street. We had a serious population. We covered all the flat complexes, the major ones, the Teresa's Gardens, Dolphin House, St Michael's Estate, Fatima Mansions, the famous Fatima Mansions. I arrested a young man, a very, very skinny young lad. I arrested him in a plaster mouldings factory up in Dolphin's Barn. They charged him with burglary. I released him. He didn't appear in court. About 3 weeks later, I was called to a flat in Dolphin House, and I saw this individual lying dead on a couch, ballooned up. He was dead for several days and the heat was on or whatever, with a needle stuck in his arm.
That was retired Garda Sergeant John Wilson, who was stationed in the inner city during the height of the heroin epidemic. A new movement aimed at combating the growth of the heroin trade was forming in the same area at this time. Disparate inner city community groups, worried about the growth of the drugs industry, began to try and run dealers out of their respective localities. All this did, however, was create mistrust and further fragment already vulnerable neighbourhoods. This led to the establishment of Citywide, a vehicle for inner-city communities to collectivise and turn their attention to lobbying politicians and lawmakers for change. Anna Quigley is the coordinator of Citywide Drugs Campaign, and she says that for a long time community groups supported harsh punishments for drug offences.
There was still a lot of support for it. Tough approach from the law and order end, even though people were very clear we need the services on the ground, for drug users, we need the prevention. There would still generally like that minimum sentencing thing. I know at the time that was something that was being called for in communities. They felt, look, you know, you've got people involved in major drug dealing and the sentences aren't stiff enough. So I think back in the 90s, certainly that need for a law and order approach would have been quite popular. And I think, again, it's probably when you're coming from a situation where there has been no, you know, for a long time, there was no action being taken at all. It just kind of pushed people into that when they see nothing has been done.
As time went by, with no noticeable increase in service provision, attitudes began to change. Citywide drew up its most recent action plan in 2012, where for the first time the issue of drug decriminalisation was raised.
Over the years of working with people who have been using drugs, people begin to see, well, the fact that they become a criminal because of the drug use is not helping them. It's not helping in terms of their situation at the time, because it just adds an extra layer of difficulty, an extra layer of kind of engagement with police or courts or whatever it might be on top of the problems they already have. But then in the long term, as people were going into rehabilitation and beginning to look forward to move on with their lives, the fact there was, you know, criminal record stuff was an issue. Now, obviously, it wasn't all just for drug use. For a lot of people, there was other stuff there as well. But it began to, you know, people began to say, well, you know, why is actually using a drug a criminal offence?
What has criminalisation done for those communities? How has it benefited? Because it's nearly the same, always the same people who are criminalised and who are imprisoned and who get criminal records, etc. It is the same people who are suffering from the drug trade in such communities who are also the focus of the criminal justice system and all the negative connotations associated with getting a criminal record. So I think they're right to raise that question about what are the benefits of criminalisation for those communities.
That was criminologist with the Irish Health Research Board, Dr. Johnny Connolly, talking about how criminalisation has had a significant impact on socially disadvantaged areas. It's a point echoed by Anna Quigley.
If you're looking at the people who become involved in serious drug use, they're at more risk because they're already in a disadvantaged situation. So adding an illegality of what they do on top of that, bringing them into contact with the criminal justice system, is increasing the disadvantage which they're already at. And obviously, if one of the root causes is disadvantage, then giving someone an extra layer of sort of criminal record is not helpful in that.
Retired Garda Sergeant John Wilson says that implementing these changes would be a win-win for communities and Gardaí.
Everybody would benefit. The Garda Síochána would be spending less money dealing with the most miserable creatures in society. Some of these poor unfortunate people, you know, that they are wretched individuals whose lives have been blighted and destroyed. I have seen hundreds of people during my time in Kilmainham dying before my eyes. People don't like talking about the drug problem that we have. People are inclined to bury their heads in the sand. That attitude is not going to work. We have a serious, serious drug problem in this country. We have spent billions of euro throwing money at the problem. That's never going to work. We're going to have to consider other measures. Prohibition on its own is not working, has not worked, and will never work.
As was alluded to by Citywide Coordinator Anna Quigley, mandatory minimum sentencing for drug offences was introduced to Ireland in 1999. Under this amendment to the Misuse of Drugs Act, the possession of illicit drugs of any kind with a value of over €13,000 can be met with a 10-year mandatory sentence. Defenders of the amendment have pointed out that the provision allows for transparent, consistent sentencing, but its critics suggest that it lacks nuance, is open to exploitation, and fundamentally has done very little to stem the tide of drugs coming into the country. Director of the Irish Penal Reform Trust is Deirdre Malone.
The legislation is not operating in that way, and who is being caught is the very low-level courier or drug mule. So it's not, I suppose the legislation as it stands is not providing an effective solution to the problem that it was intended to address. The problem was that there was a wish to tackle significant drug supply within Ireland and particularly in Dublin. There is no evidence that presumptive mandatory minimums have done anything to actually tackle that problem.
Deirdre Malone says the IPRT has proposed a number of solutions.
Repealing that provision that prescribes a presumptive mandatory minimum. You could raise the €13,000 limit to a higher level. You could allow judges to distinguish and provide sentencing guidelines to allow them to distinguish between roles. But I suppose, you know, more broadly, what we would advocate and have always advocated is, you know, prevention, early intervention, significant investment in, I suppose, the social structures that help people to stay away from crime. In that situation, where we have a complete lack of evidence that the effectiveness of a policy, the only response should be to look at what the alternative options are and what has worked in other countries and whether or not we could use that or an adapted model of that at home.
Throughout the latter half of the 20th century, Portugal endured a drugs crisis. 1974 saw the collapse of the authoritarian Estado Novo government of António de Oliveira Salazar. The opening of the country's borders led to an influx of drugs both as a result of decolonisation and Portugal's geographical location. This, coupled with an experimentative mindset from the newly liberated Portuguese people, meant that drug use rose to epidemic levels over the years that followed. Successive governments implemented prohibitive laws and increased criminal sanction, but still the problem worsened. By 1999, it was estimated that up to 1% of the population was addicted to heroin. Then, in 2001, Portuguese authorities took what was deemed a radical approach towards the problem. They decriminalised drug use. Dr. Johnny Connolly is the Irish focal point for the European Monitoring Centre for Drugs and Drug Addiction, based in Lisbon.
The Portuguese experiment was essentially about decriminalisation within a public health context. So it was about transferring people from a criminal justice system into a public health system, basically, and diverting them away from the criminal justice process through these dissuasion committees. So highlighting the reality that it is a public health issue. It is not a criminal justice issue primarily. Addiction is a public health problem.
A spike in drug use followed the Portuguese policy of decriminalisation, which peaked in 2007. As of 2 years ago, the numbers using drugs had dropped to pre-2001 levels when drug use was still treated with criminal sanction. Dr. Connolly says the policy has brought about positive change when it comes to public health.
There hasn't really been any sustained increase in drug use, but there has been a rapid drop in drug-related deaths. And that's often the important byproduct of initiatives like this, because what you're doing is you're removing the stigma attached with a health problem, essentially. And it's encouraging more people to come into treatment and to become visible to public health. And that means you can address their addiction needs, you can address the harms that they are inflicting on themselves. And as a consequence, one of the most important indicators you would hope for is that you're saving lives. And that is one of the clear consequences of it. There has been a significant drop in drug-related deaths.
The policy now enjoys support across partisan lines, even from those who initially opposed it. But European austerity means that its full potential has yet to be realised.
While there was a lot of opposition to it, now there is no opposition to it. People from all political persuasions agree with the policy and support it. The problem at the moment, I believe, with Portugal is that austerity, as it impacted in Ireland, it also impacted in Portugal. You had significant cutbacks against, in terms of treatment. When you've got huge high levels of increase in unemployment in Portugal, the idea, as was part of their system, of sort of promoting, employment and positive discrimination for employment for dependent drug users, it's hard to get away with that when you're in the position of austerity and when you've got huge unemployment rates amongst the general population and there's less sympathy for those who are, dependent drug users.
Due to mounting evidence, including the National Review of Drugs and Crime in Ireland, published by the Irish Health Research Board last year, the need for a review of Ireland's drug policy has begun to cross over from advocacy groups and into the political mainstream. The minister with responsibility for drug policy is Éan Ó'Riordan.
Instinctively, I think that if somebody has a substance abuse problem, then they should be treated fundamentally as a patient, as somebody with a medical need. And if you fundamentally change your attitude into about drug abuse and look at what the person needs, then you wouldn't put them into cold storage for 30 years in the methadone program, and also you wouldn't have them going through the criminal justice system when what they really need is a different type of intervention. I don't think it's sustainable to have 70% of the drug cases going through our courts being people who have been caught in possession of drugs for their own personal use. It's a waste of guard's time, it's a waste of the court's time. Somebody of that nature, I think, needs an intervention and possibly needs a sanction, but doesn't need to be criminalised, in my view. We're not dealing with criminals, we're dealing with people with medical need, and they should be helped as somebody with a medical need.
It's a sentiment echoed by clinical director of the Rutland Centre, psychologist Dr. Erica Ruarock.
Complex situations are rarely successfully addressed with simple responses, so an approach that focused more on enriching people's opportunities in life rather than limiting through criminalisation is likely to be more successful.
For Kerry-born Kevin, who's in recovery, the stigma of criminalisation still looms large.
I suppose with these laws as well, it's holding me back from going for these jobs, and even a college course, and everything like that. That's holding me back at the moment, because when I came up here, I was asked to start looking into college and everything, and the head started going straight away, sure, I'd be wasting my time, because look, I'm a known criminal, even though I haven't been in trouble for many years, but look, they're going to root back to my past, so for me, that's holding me back at the moment,
Tony has been free of drugs and alcohol for the past year. The journey hasn't been an easy one for him.
I thought that has to be more than life. It has to be more. And I was suicidal a year and a half ago. And I thought, give it a go. See what it's like. What people say, being clean, you can get clean. I never thought I could get a day clean off methadone. I was tied down to Pier Street for
since I came back in 2001 on the methadone clinic there and using in between. This time I just said, right, I'd lost my son, lost the relationship with my wife. Family was still there, but I was just bet myself.
The addict that's on the street, trying to deal with his pain with no home to go to and everything, Joe. But you have these drug dealers as well, like, that are driving around their big cars and everything. And I don't think that they should be treated the same. I don't think I chose to be a heroin addict, like, do you know, I really believe that, like, do you know. But now I know these days I have a choice, like, I think back then I thought I didn't have a choice. I thought that was me, like, do you know.
I think I was kind of one of the lucky ones in there, because I know a lot of friends who couldn't get a passport, they're trying to get forms stamped and everything would go against them. So I was kind of a little bit lucky along them lines, you know. If you've done any time and that's going against and you can't get passports or you can't get away on holiday, that should be changed. That the person could be changing, you know. Like, I've done stuff through addiction. I know people have done stuff to feed their habits. We've all done things like that to feed our habit. There's people getting clean in prisons now. You know, I know there's an awful lot now, but there's a bulk, there's people going into prison and staying clean now, and I think when they come out of there, they should be able to move on and forward their lives rather than always this label and tags hanging over them, you know.
For former heroin addict and service users advocate Niall O'Connell, the decision to quit was a pragmatic one.
The more frequent I ask the question, you know, why am I going to these extremes to get this drug, the more I was coming back with the answer, saying I don't know, because all I'm getting from it at the end of the day is a little bit of sedation. Which if I walked into a pharmacy and bought a packet of night nurse and took one or two of the night nurse, I'd achieve the same effect. And I was going, I'm just getting tired of this. But in tandem with that, my methadone dose was gone up. That was blocking the effects of heroin. So when I was using the heroin, you wouldn't get the effects that you were getting initially. It's certainly not when you started out using it. But I just said, you know, this is a motor. I'm losing every penny I have. I'm losing my veins. I've nearly killed myself a few times.
Throughout this programme, we've heard from former addicts, legal representatives, criminologists, ex-Gardaí, advocates, psychologists and government ministers, all of whom are of the opinion that Ireland's drug laws are in need of redress. The evidence gathered and produced by these figures show that the removal of criminal sanction for drug addicts would be a positive step for society as a whole. Dr. Erica Rurock says that more money needs to be invested into treatment services.
I would really hope that our policies would speak to the needs for treatment. Our treatment services are pretty meagre in Ireland for a country that has such entrenched difficulties, particularly with alcohol. Our access to treatment is pretty limited through the statutory funding agencies.
Minister of State Eoin O'Riordan says there's a need to remove the stigma of drug addiction.
What happens sometimes where people on the edge of society, we begin to call them names. We use nicknames to describe them. We almost describe them as being some kind of a subculture. And if you do that, then you dehumanise them. If you dehumanise them, then you don't treat them as citizens in the Republic. And we've done that with various different groups in society. And we've done it with substance, people with substance problems as well. And we need to stop doing that. Do we really think people have a future? Do we actually fundamentally believe that people can change their habit, can rehabilitate themselves? Do we actually believe fundamentally that that they deserve that? And I think they do.
Old man, look at my life. I'm a lot like you were. Old man, look at my life. I'm a lot like you were.
I don't believe that people that use drugs are criminals. Like, I just not. I know it's not the case. And technically, they might be criminals, but in reality, they'd be the furthest thing from criminals. You know? All types of people use drugs. That will always be the case.
People change. You know what I mean? rather than being just labelled with drug addicts, this is your blade and you're a drug addict and you'll never change, because that, I think, for me, that has been a perspective a lot of people that haven't seen. You're a drug addict, you'll never change, you know. I believed it for years, so I'm 45 now, nearly 46, and I believed that I was never going to change myself.
I thought I'd never be where I'm at, like, you know. I really didn't, like. And if this is as good as it gets, that's good for me at the moment, you know. And that's honestly where I'm at, like, because I couldn't dream of this last year.
Decriminalising Addiction, Changing Ireland's Approach to Drug Policy was produced by Anthony McFeely for the DCU Masters in Journalism programme. To listen back to this or any other Newstalk documentary, go to newstalk.com/documentary on Newstalk.